keeping young Muslims busy and away from terrorist recruiters.
It is a struggle, experts say, that is not limited to Norway. Muslim communities in other countries are facing similar difficulties.
Helping homeless women in one of the richest areas of the United States.
For people that are looking at you like you're nothing, treating you like you ain't worth nothing, that's the hard part.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at The Voice of America in Washington. Ann Ball, Ashley Thompson, and Jonathan Evans will bring you those stories today. Then, in his weekly technology report, Jonathan Evans will tell us how robots are being used to develop drugs to fight malaria and other tropical diseases.
How it works conventionally is you use robotics as well, and you have a large collection of possible drugs.
Then we bring you our regular weekday series, The Making of a Nation. Today, we tell you about some of the times in American history when the federal government attacked personal rights. Government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others because they feared they were communists trying to take over the United States.
Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy.
Finally, in our American Moments series, we take you back to 1943 and the dedication of one of the most popular places in Washington, D.C. If you have visited the nation's capital, you have almost certainly seen this memorial and statue honoring one of the most famous of the country's founders. This is As It Is, a daily 30-minute program from VOA Learning English. Every day, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Oslo, Norway, is one of a growing number of cities in Europe that has seen an increase in the population of Muslims. Like many communities across Europe, Oslo's Muslims are struggling to keep their youth from joining extremist groups like the Islamic State. Some observers say many of the continent's Muslim communities do not have enough to offer young people. Ann Ball and Ashley Thompson report.
Yusuf Bartho Asadiq is with the Project on Radicalization and Extremism at Norway's Minotek Research Center. He told VOA many Islamic centers in the country are having a hard time providing enough activities for young people. Mr. Asadiq says this lack of activity offers extremist groups a chance to reach out and recruit those young people. He described the leaders of these groups as the world's best social workers. It is a struggle, experts say, that is not limited to Norway. Muslim communities in other countries are facing similar difficulties.
While Europe is struggling, Muslim communities in the United States have seen smaller numbers of young people being recruited. U.S. intelligence officials say they are following about 150 Americans who have gone or have tried to go to Syria or Iraq.
Observers suggest several reasons for the lower number of American jihadists. One reason is that American Muslim communities offer stronger youth and community programs. Kelly Pemberton teaches religion and women's studies at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She says many U.S. Muslims create connections and combine resources with other American Muslim communities. She says this kind of solidarity does not exist in Europe, at least not the same level of support.
Saeed Saeed works at the Islamic Society of North America's Office for Interfaith and Community Alliances. He says European Muslim communities can have the same success as America's Muslim communities, but he says it will not be easy. He says Muslims who moved to Europe were never accepted by the whole society as equals or as partners. He says they would always talk as if they belonged somewhere else. Mr. Saeed says Europe's Muslim communities often remain separate from the wider community and split because of the ethnic differences. He says they often look to their home countries for religious leaders.
In the United States, however, things are different. In Mr. Saeed's words, today we have American-born imams, or religious leaders. We have slowly been able to replace earlier imams who could not talk to our teenagers, to our wives, and who could not mix in with the rest of society. It is a major journey that we have taken, he says. Mr. Saeed and Professor Pemberton say Europe's Muslims will need help from European governments to deal with discrimination and a lack of economic opportunities for them. But the professor does not think that will happen anytime soon. In fact, she sees the opposite happening. France's government has stepped up its policing of Muslim communities, she notes. There have been anti-Muslim demonstrations in some European countries, including France and Germany. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Anne Ball.
It's always a place for the angry young man with his working class ties and his radical plans. He refuses to bend, he refuses to crawl. And he's always at home with his back to the wall. And he's proud of the scars and the battles he's lost. And he struggles and bleeds.
You are listening to As It Is from the Voice of America. Many homeless people live in what is called the Skid Row area of Los Angeles, California. These are men and women who have no permanent place to live. But Skid Row is a place where many social service groups can be found. These groups work to help the homeless find work and a place to live. Jonathan Evans reports on one such organization that works with women.
Skid Row is like no other place in Los Angeles. The homeless fill its sidewalks at all times of the day. Yolanda Waters has a job as a barista. She prepares and sells coffee. But she was once homeless and spent time in Skid Row.
It's a place that where everybody is dumped, you know. And if you don't ask for help, you're not going to get help. For people that are looking at you like you're nothing, treating you like you ain't worth nothing, that's the hard part.
Ms. Waters received help from the Downtown Women's Center. The center trains homeless women and helps them find work so they can live in a place of their own. It shows them how to create candles, greeting cards, and other products. The program teaches the women to arrive on time, complete a project, and work in a group. Joe Altapeter is head of vocational education at the center.
Rebuilding self-esteem, developing relationships with individuals, you know, chronic homelessness when you're living on the streets, you become isolated. So this is an opportunity to really deal with those issues.
He adds that about one-fourth of the 58,000 homeless people in Los Angeles are women. The high cost of housing is one reason they do not have a permanent place to call home. Poor women are more at risk of being homeless. Many homeless women struggle with mental problems or have been abused. The center gives them advice, health care, and support.
They come into the workshops, they might not have a really great community of friends or a support network, but they're entering this safe and supportive environment which offers that for them.
The things the women make are sold at the Downtown Women's Center and at Bloomingdale's, a store selling high-priced goods. Each handmade craft has a sign showing where it was made. Kathy Suto works at Bloomingdale's. She says the store has sold many of the crafts the women have made. She says she hopes other businesses will sell them.
We have been very pleasantly surprised. It is something I'm now working to get the other five Bloomingdale stores in the Los Angeles market to start carrying as part of their assortment.
Yolanda Waters did not enjoy making crafts, but she did like making drinks in a small restaurant at the Downtown Women's Center. After training there, she got a job. Now, she has an apartment home and a reason to get out of bed.
It feels unreal, and because sometimes I think when I wake up that, you know, is it real? Do I have this real job, a real job that I really love?
I'm Jonathan Evans.
Well, not long ago I was a happy man. Money in my pocket with a ring on my hand. My money's all gone and I'm feeling low. Standing on the corner of Skid Row. I got an old...
Time now to check in on the latest technology news. Jonathan Evans is here again. This week he tells us about how robots are being used as laboratory partners. He says the robots might be used to help create drugs that might not otherwise be developed.
Robots are common in today's world. They manufacture cars, work in space, explore oceans, clean up oil spills, and investigate dangerous environments. And now, scientists at the University of Manchester are using a robot as a laboratory partner. The researchers at the university created the robot in 2009 and named it Adam. Despite the name, Adam is not a humanoid robot. It is about the size of a car. Adam was built to do science and make discoveries. Ross King is the leader of the University of Manchester research team. He says the robot made a discovery about yeast, a kind of fungus used in science as a model for human cells.
Adam hypothesized certain functions of genes within yeast and experimentally tested these hypotheses and confirmed them. So it both hypothesized and experimentally confirmed new scientific knowledge.
Adam's success as a scientist led to the creation of another robot scientist named Eve. Researchers developed Eve to design and test drugs for tropical and neglected diseases. These diseases kill and infect millions of people each year. Drug development is slow and costly. Experts say it can take more than 10 years and about $1 billion to discover and develop new medicines. Drug manufacturers are unlikely to get their investment money back. So the University of Manchester developed a low-cost test that shows whether or not a chemical is likely to be made into an effective medicine. Mr. King says that other drug testing methods were not very effective.
How it works conventionally is you use robotics as well, and you have a large collection of possible drugs. You test every single compound, so you start at the beginning of your library and continue to the end, then stop. So it's not a very intelligent process. The robotics doesn't learn anything as it goes along. Even if it's tested a million compounds, it still doesn't have any expectation of what will happen next when it tests a new compound.
Mr. King says that Eve is different because the robot learns as it tests different compounds. He says the robot is designed to ignore compounds that it thinks unlikely to be good. It will only test the compounds which have a good chance of working. Eve has discovered that a compound known to be effective against cancer might also be used to fight against malaria and other tropical diseases. Mr. King says he hopes to completely automate the drug testing process with robots like Eve to create and test new chemicals. But he says humans remain in control of the manufacturing process. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. Now it's time for our daily The Making of a Nation program. The United States Constitution guarantees freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. The Bill of Rights in the Constitution protects these and other individual rights. But the government has not always honored all of the rights in the Constitution. In the 1700s, for example, President John Adams supported laws to stop Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Party from criticizing the government. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln took strong actions to prevent newspapers from printing military news. And during the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused innocent people of being communists and traitors. Some of the most serious government attacks on personal rights took place in 1919 and 1920. Some government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others. Today on The Making of a Nation, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about what came to be known as the Red Scare.
These actions took place because of American fears about the threat of communism. Those fears were tied closely to the growth of the organized labor movement during World War I. There were a number of strikes during the war. More and more often, workers were willing to risk their jobs and join together to try to improve working conditions. President Woodrow Wilson had long supported organized labor, and he tried to get workers and business owners to negotiate peacefully. But official support for organized labor ended when strikes closed factories that were important to the national war effort. President Wilson and his advisors felt workers should put the national interest before their private interest. They told workers to wait until after the war to demand more pay and better working conditions.
In general, American workers did wait. But when the war finally ended in 1918, American workers began to strike in large numbers for higher pay. As many as 2 million workers went on strike in 1919. There were strikes by house builders, meat cutters, and train operators. And there were strikes in the shipyards, the shoe factories, and the telephone companies. Most striking workers wanted the traditional goals of labor unions, more pay and shorter working hours. But a growing number of them also began to demand major changes in the economic system itself. They called for government control of certain private industries. Railroad workers, for example, wanted the national government to take permanent control of running the trains. Coal miners, too, demanded government control of their industry. And even in the conservative grain-farming states, 200,000 farmers joined a group that called for major economic changes.
All these protests came as a shock to traditional Americans who considered their country to be the home of free business. They saw little need for labor unions, and they feared that the growing wave of strikes meant the United States faced the same revolution that had just taken place in Russia. After all, Lenin himself had warned that the Bolshevik Revolution would spread to workers in other countries. Several events in 1919 only increased this fear of violent revolution. A bomb exploded in the home of a senator from the southeastern state of Georgia, and someone even exploded a bomb in front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, the nation's chief law officer. However, the most frightening event was a strike by police in Boston, Massachusetts. The policemen demanded higher wages, but the police chief refused to negotiate with them. As a result, the policemen went on strike. When they did, thieves began to break into unprotected homes and shops. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge finally had to call out state troops to protect the people. His action defeated the strike. Most of the policemen lost their jobs.
All this was too much for many Americans. They began to accuse labor unions and others of planning a revolution. And they launched a forceful campaign to protect the country from these suspected extremists. Leaders of this campaign accused thousands of people of being communists or Reds. The campaign became known as the Red Scare. Of course, most people were honestly afraid of revolution. They did not trust the many foreigners who were active in unions, and they were tired of change and social unrest after the bloody World War. A number of these Americans in different cities began to take violent actions against people and groups that they suspected of being communist extremists. In New York, a crowd of men in military uniforms attacked the office of a socialist newspaper. They beat the people working there and destroyed the equipment. In the western city of Centralia, Washington, 4 people were killed in a violent fight between union members and their opponents. Public feeling was against the labor unions and political leftists. Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy. Many state and local governments passed laws making it a crime to belong to organizations that supported revolution. 28 states passed laws making it a crime to wave red flags.
People also demanded action from the national government. President Wilson was sick and unable to see the situation clearly. He cared about little except his dream of the United States joining the new League of Nations. But Attorney General Palmer heard the calls for action. Palmer hoped to be elected president the next year. He decided to take strong actions to gain the attention of voters. One of Palmer's first actions as Attorney General was to prevent coal miners from going on strike. Next, he ordered a series of raids to arrest leftist leaders. A number of these arrested people were innocent of any crime, but officials kept many of them in jail without charges for weeks. Palmer expelled from the country a number of foreigners suspected of revolutionary activity. He told reporters that communists were criminals who planned to overthrow everything that was good in life.
Feelings of fear and suspicion extended to other parts of American life. Many persons and groups were accused of supporting communism. Such famous Americans as actor Charlie Chaplin, educator John Dewey, and law professor Felix Frankfurter were among those accused. The Red Scare caused many innocent people to be afraid to express their ideas. They feared they might be accused of being a communist. But as quickly as the Red Scare swept across the country, so too did it end in 1920. In just a few months, people began to lose trust in Attorney General Palmer. They became tired of his extreme actions. Republican leader Charles Evans Hughes and other leading Americans called for the Justice Department to obey the law in arresting and charging people.
By the summer of 1920, the Red Scare was over. Even a large bomb explosion in New York in September did not change the opinion of most Americans that the nation should return to free speech and the rule of law.
The Red Scare did not last long, but it was an important event. It showed that many Americans after World War I were tired of social changes. They wanted peace and business growth. Of course, the traditional way for Americans to show their feelings is through elections. And this growing conservatism of the nation showed itself clearly in the presidential election of 1920. That election will be the subject of our program tomorrow. Finally, it was on this day, April 13, 1943, that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt led ceremonies to dedicate the National Monument to Thomas Jefferson in Washington, D.C. It was the 200th anniversary of Jefferson's birth. Thomas Jefferson was the third president of the United States. He was the main author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom and, later, the U.S. Declaration of Independence. He is considered one of the greatest champions of political and spiritual freedom in American history. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you, and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. Jim Tedder will be here tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is, from the Voice of America.